Ladies and gentlemen, we had Sue Wright in a while ago, and she's fascinating. I was delighted to spend a little bit of time on Christmas Day with Sue Wright and Mark Wright and Johnny Poole and Colette Poole at the Hanover Street Social. And I saw Sue Wright in action where it comes to charity and helping other people. Having said that, a few nights before, I went to an auction that she'd done for another charity. First of all, Sue, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Where did this passion come from?
I didn't have a great childhood growing up. So I was quite aware from a very early stage that people, and particularly young people, faced difficulties. And I left school at 16 with no qualifications. Well, one O-level, as it was then. And I always thought that I'd be able to walk into some amazing job and be able to talk to somebody across the desk and be able to persuade them that I was the person for that job. And of course, without paper qualifications, I never got an interview. So by the time I was about 16 and a half, I thought, better do something about this. So I went back to college and I went to Southport Tech, as it was then, and I did a bunch of O-levels and BTEC courses and all the rest of it. And I ended up with a passion for law, and I got enough qualifications together by the time I was 19 to be able to then go do a full-time law degree. And at that point, Lancashire Polytechnic, as it was then, took students on not just on their qualifications, because I didn't have A-levels, but also on a personal interview. And I just told them my story, and I said, look, this is what I've been doing for the last 4 years. I've tried to turn my life around. I really do want to do a law degree. And they gave me the opportunity, which I'm always grateful for, to go and do a law degree there. I think whilst that was happening and whilst I was studying for a law degree, I went to a chip shop one night as a student. And whilst I was waiting in the chip shop, there's some random newspaper on the counter, and I flipped through it. And in the Liverpool Echo, there's a little article with a guy from Garston who was bringing over about 50 children from Chernobyl, which obviously back then, you know, hadn't been, it was quite recent. And I thought, my God, what an amazing thing he's doing. He was asking for volunteers. So I got in touch with him. And to cut a long story short, I got involved with it, and we started bringing over kids from Chernobyl each year. And Alder Hey were giving these kids vitamin injections, and we got them to a dentist, and we got them clothed. And the volunteer that would come over with them the first year, and I said to her, and I was only like 19, 20 myself, and I said to her, you know, you're doing all this for these kids. We'd like to buy something just for you. What would you like? And she said to me, there's only one thing I'm just desperate for. I dream about all the time. And I said, what? And she said, an iron. And I thought that just said it all, that, you know, this woman from such desperate circumstances who was trying to help these kids was just in so need of an iron. So a culmination of things, really, Pete, that, you know, my own circumstances, being quite acutely aware of people around me, and also being ready to react and have that kind of tenacious personality, which I have, which once I see something, you know, I put a plan in of how to execute it and make it happen. Same as you do in business. You know, you research, you prepare, you put messages out on Facebook, bring people together. Power of the community is immense. You know, we've had some really successful stories over the year, which has just happened because of the power of the community. And sometimes it just takes somebody to step forward and put their head above the parapet to say, listen, guys, this needs rectifying or this needs fixing. Can you all help to do it? Not everybody is born, not saying I'm born a leader, but I'm perhaps a bit more gobby than some people, and I'm a bit more pushy, and I'm not afraid of asking, because somebody can only say no. So I'm quite bold on that front. You know, whether it's, you know, whatever we need, housing, clothing, duvets, whatever it is, I'm not afraid to go out and ask for it. And then other people will fall in and come and support you on that. And not everybody feels that they have the time or the attitude to be able to maybe make that first step.
But you have the time and attitude?
I definitely have the attitude, and I make the time. So, for example, you know, that we have a mantra in our house, which we say every day, or I say every day. Now Mark says it every day because I say it every day, which is, you've not lived today until you have done something for somebody who can never repay you. And that's really important to us as a family, that, you know, you should always try and help somebody. You can't do it every day, but as much as you can. You know, we're all very, very fortunate for what we have in our lives, you know, our health and our families and food in the cupboards. And, you know, if I never bought any more clothes again, I've got enough clothes in my wardrobe to last me the rest of my life. You know, but we are surrounded by consumerism and expectations of how we should look and what we should be buying and what we should be driving. And I'm not saying for one minute that's wrong, because I like nice things. I like to drive a nice car. I like to have nice clothes. But at the same time as having those, we still have space in our lives to help others as well.
Christmas Day, briefly, because I want to talk about Christmas Day. I want to talk about Heswell while we're here, and then talk about fostering. Christmas Day was incredibly rewarding. Mm. There were, it was overboard because the presents were ridiculous.
Yeah.
You'd really... I think you were overwhelmed at the generosity of people. The whole day was lovely.
Yeah.
But there was a real cross-section of people there, wasn't there?
There was. In fact, I've just been with some of them this morning before I came in here. What a lot of people don't know in this city, and in fact, I rang a local TV station last week and asked them to do an article on it, and they didn't. And I'm very disappointed. But there are 300 families, including about 170 children from Aleppo, which have recently arrived here. And those kids from Aleppo arrived with the clothes which they stood up in. You know, these are kids that have come across on the boats, then living in the camps, the jungle camp in Calais. These kids have just got nothing. So some of those families we brought in, and they came in on Christmas Day. And some families were from families that we're in touch with who are living in temporary accommodation, hostels, victims of domestic violence, etc. And literally they have nothing and no money to buy a present on Christmas Day. One family who I've recently put out on Facebook a particular support request to help, single mum, a victim of horrific domestic violence in London, three kids. She just got on a train and arrived in Liverpool with the clothes she stood up in. And the city council put her up in a hotel for two nights and then put her up into a furnished house in Tewbrook. the landlord should be named and shamed for it, but that's not my space. I went to the house last week. The children were choosing to sleep on the floor because the disgusting, thin, wiry mattresses were so uncomfortable and so dirty and so smelly that it was better for them to sleep on the floor than to sleep on the mattresses. So she was given a furnished accommodation which has this quality of furniture in it, four cups, four spoons, four knives, four forks, two chairs. So in the kitchen, whenever they eat a meal, two family members have to stand up. That's people, how people are living in our city right this minute. I just spoke to another woman an hour ago who was crying, telling me, you know, she gets £5 a day allowance because she's a refugee. She gets £5 a day allowance, but to come into town to try and talk to somebody about her benefits costs her £4.80 on the bus with her two children. So she either sits at home and puts up with what she's got, or she spends £4.80 out of her £5 to get into town to try and make it better.
Let me ask you a question, a negative question, which I know there will be listeners now, because I've done this for an awful long time. Should look after her own first.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
I say that me personally, I do a lot for children and families in this city, and equally I will help any child or family from another city as well. So for me, I don't believe we should be making a distinction, but I do agree that we shouldn't be making anybody any particular importance or prioritisation, but we should be trying to help everybody as much as we can.
Does it frustrate you, Sue, because you can't help everybody?
You can't help everybody.
There
is so much help needed. I mean, we've got some ideas this year for 2017 for a huge project to help the homeless, and that's going to be a big financial multi-agency cross-section between public and private sector effort, of which we're going to get some key players together to be able to do that. Hopefully, maybe come back and talk to you about that another time when we've got that off the ground. But that is a big project. The amount of homeless people in Liverpool isn't huge. The figures fluctuate between 40 and 50 people. So, you know, if we as a city can't rehome 40 or 50 people, then as a society, there's a fundamental flaw in our fabric. And we as a society should be able to assist those people quite easily. It's not just about putting a roof over people's heads, though. It's much more fundamentally deep than that.
But do you not believe, Sue, that there are people out there that don't want it, that don't want responsibility, certainly don't want bills? They actually, yes, they don't like sleeping in this dreadful weather, but they also like the freedom to go where they want.
So what our proposal would be in relation to that is that we propose that we have two types of projects, that we're going to have a project which we're going to call sort of Our House, which means that it's where it's almost a community-based living accommodation, so nobody has to sleep rough. There will always be somewhere for them to be homed. And that means that there'll be on-site counselling, on-site therapy, on-site GP, or access, all those sorts of things. But when they are ready, and if they wish to move on, then we help them to move on to Your House.
Simple as that. Let's give a big plug to Heswell now, because you are passionate about this amazing little place tucked away.
Well, how that came about is that Mark took me into Heswell one day for a coffee, and we went to Costa. It was a cold, wintry day, and we walked back from Costa, and we walked past Puddingdale Fields, and there on the fields were these bunch of adults playing football. And the adults were a mixture of autistic adults and Down syndrome adults. And they were playing football really passionately and loving it. And their goals were two metal chairs, you know, like you used to do at school or on your green. Two metal chairs either end, no goals, no nets. And a volunteer, like a 60-odd-year-old volunteer in each end from the centre being the goalkeeper. So every time we stood and watched, and every time one of them scored a goal, of course, it would go past the volunteer, and the volunteer would then have to walk half a mile down the park to go and pick the ball up. Play would stop, walk back with the ball, start again. So Mark and I had stood there just watching this, and Mark's going, "This is wrong. Why haven't they got nets? Why haven't they got goalposts? It's just basic equipment." So, of course, Mark and I, being Mark and I, within 10 minutes were in the manager's office reorganising his life, and you know, and Mark just put out on his Twitter a request for anyone to donate goals or nets, and you know, they were playing in their shoes, they didn't even have trainers or football boots, and then they got walked back, it's full of mud, and you know, the dogs are on there and all the rest of it, and they walk back into the centre and they're in their muddy shoes all day. And you know, if that had been a mainstream school, they would have had, or a mainstream college, they would have had that basic equipment. So why shouldn't they have that basic equipment just because they're autistic or Down syndrome users? So Mark put it out on his Twitter. We were, again, overwhelmed with the response. We had a number of sets of goals delivered, including one lovely guy who drove from Kent with a £2,000 set of magnificent professional goals and nets. Somebody came in from North Wales with kit for them all. We got boots donated. We got them signed by local players, John Barnes, and everybody signed the boots, gave them all boots. It was just a tremendous opportunity for them to get proper kit. And then whilst we were speaking to the manager, he said to us, "Oh, you know, there's local tournaments which they would love to be involved in, but the minibus on the front hasn't had MOT and no road tax for 6 months because there's no MOT on it." So Richie Horton, who owns Birkenhead Van Hire, within 2 days, he'd had the minibus turned round for them, back on the road. So practical, easy, simple solutions which make a massive difference to somebody, of getting that transport in place, which means that those adults can then go and compete. Mark then rang up the County FA and got them involved in the disability team at the County FA. So now they can integrate with other centres around the North West and be in competitions.
And they need money for to keep the room, the hall.
Well, that's their day centre, which is on a day-to-day basis. So those adults go there to to be looked after and give respite to their carers and their parents throughout the day. And we just do a very small fundraiser each year. The room can only fit about 80 to 100 of us in it. And each this year we raised £2,400, which was great. And it's not a massive amount of money. I mean, you're talking about China last time I was in here, you know, huge amounts of money raised. It's a small amount of money, but it can make a big difference. So that amount of money bought them 6 computers, which they were delighted with, to have be able to have access to computers and start being able to access the internet, etc.
And looking from Heswell, when you drive, you wouldn't know it was there.
Correct. It's tucked
away. Because it's not Heswell Hall, it's Heswell...
It's Heswell Centre.
Centre.
It's opposite Tesco. And that's one of the reasons we do the fundraiser in there, is because we wanted people from that community to actually come into that centre and recognise it is there and see what they've done. You know, the beautiful art and the beautiful creative pieces that they've created around the room. And feel as though it's part of their community.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because something when you showed me around stuck with me as well. They make a little bit of money by stealing tiles.
So the manager is very creative and he has a history in art. So he likes to make mosaics. So they couldn't afford to buy tiles. So this manager was going to the local tile shops and he basically said to them, "Well, any broken tiles can I have?" And he was like, "Yeah, go in the bin." And there's loads in the bins in the back of the tile shops. And so he was in the bins getting all these broken tiles out. I mean, that's how committed the staff were just to be able
and
to bring
fabulous.
Them back. Amazing mosaics.
Incredible.
Yeah,
incredible.
If anyone wants mosaics,
really
it's
good.
Place to go.
So you're a fascinating lady. You have a lot of passion. We spoke before, we're speaking again. But one thing that did come over to me from you and Mark, I'm an adopted boy. I'm one of the lucky ones. God knows where I would have finished up, but I got an amazing mother. The woman that gave me away gave me into an amazing woman. So thank you for that. That's all I say about that. Over the years, I've been on Radio City 2. I've tried to help as much as possible fostering. It is difficult. It isn't easy. We talk about babies. We talk about older children. You and Mark are passionate about fostering. Please use the airways.
Thank you. Well, Mark and I became foster carers 8 years ago, nearly 9 years ago. It was something growing up that I always wanted to do in my adult life. And I just qualified as a foster carer before I met Mark. And I said to him on our first date, "Just to let you know that I do want to become a foster carer." So that is, you know, part of my life plan. But he obviously accepted it because there was a second date. So we went into our lives together, knowing that at some point we would definitely foster. And, you know, we ended up fostering and we have adopted a daughter as well. She's 11 now. And Mark's got 4 children from his first marriage. So we have 5 kids between us. And we currently have 3 foster kids in placement as well. So we now got 8 kids between us. So we have a very busy household, but we love it. And, you know, all our kids are really happy and safe. And we recognise, you know, myself and Mark in particular, recognise that, you know, we have an opportunity in our lives to be able to help other children who aren't as fortunate as our own kids. And that's really the message, you know. It's difficult sometimes for people. Lots of people like the idea of being able to foster, but actually getting to the point of being qualified as a foster carer is quite a rich tapestry of a journey. What I would say to people who are thinking about fostering or who have thought about fostering but have never made the phone call is just make the phone call. Make the phone call to your local authority and have a chat with the social worker and talk it through with them. Because if you don't do that phone call, you'll never know whether fostering is for you. It's not for everybody. You know, and you have got to have a spare room for the child. So, you know, that's your first barrier, so to speak. But if you can get over those and you can speak to the social worker, then, you know, it is the most rewarding job, if you can call it a job, most rewarding part of your life, to be able to give a home to a child who would otherwise perhaps be separated from their siblings or who have been through such traumatic experience that they need a home which is just surrounded by you know, love and fun.
And it's not about babies, it's everything.
Oh, every all age group. Children, yeah. All age. I mean, every local authority is desperate for children to be fostered. There is 10,000 foster carers short in the UK. And it's not just about babies. Teenagers are often difficult to place only because, you know, a lot of teenagers get a bad press and foster carers will get a phone call and say, oh, I've got a 14-year-old boy, he's run away from the last two foster placements. And a lot of foster carers will think, oh, he's going to run away from mine, he's going to bring trouble to the door. Not all those teenagers would do. Sometimes they just need guidance and somebody to take a chance with them.
Tell me, all the time you've been fostering, do you find the rules and regulations getting a bit more difficult? As in, and I'm going to speak my mind, I get told that you're not supposed to hug a child, you're not supposed to do this, you know. And surely when a child is fostered, that's the one thing they need, is love more than anything.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. There are specific rules in place which are put in place for good reason. Some of the reasons behind that is that you need to be able to protect yourself and your family from allegations being made. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you can hug your foster children, you know, but there's a fine line. Yeah. Yeah, it's a fine line. You know, you have to make sure that however you express your affection and love to that child, it's very, you know, it's very clear. It is a very difficult area, but all those rules and regulations are in place for a reason. You know, for example, you have to keep diary notes of everything that's happened each day, and that can be quite time consuming, but you just make a quick note of what's happened during the day. But those challenges are far outweighed by the results of what you put into fostering.
How do you cope with saying goodbye to a child?
Very difficult, no matter what circumstances surround a child leaving placement. It's always very traumatic for you, the child and the family. And you often think about those children and where those children are now. We had some children placed with us last summer, twin boys, and we still think about them now, you know, wonder where they are and what they're doing and how they are and all the rest of it. So they become a part of your life very, very quickly. You know, it's very difficult to you know, again, you're not a machine, you're human, you know, even though you're...
Is it difficult for your children, or was it difficult for your children to accept fostering?
It was difficult in some aspects at the beginning, because our older kids then were obviously younger teenagers then, and were, you know, going through teenager times and all the rest of it. But we got through that very quickly, and now, without shadow of a doubt, the older kids love the prospect of fostering. And in fact, Mark's daughter Holly wants to be, you know, foster carer when she grows up. So it's almost like a generational thing. You know, our daughter, our 11-year-old daughter, wants to foster and adopt. When she grows up, she was fostered and adopted. So she understands the principles and the challenges about fostering adoption, and recognises there are so many children out there who need help, who need families.
I met your children, the foster children. When I first met them, I was incredibly impressed with what you did with them. And what it was, at the beginning I thought, is this right? And then straight away I went, yes, it is right. I was introduced to them and they shook my hand, said who they were, and I went, you're giving them a hell of a grounding. And that's the theory behind it, isn't it?
Just what that is about is that we have a very busy household. You know, there's lots of people, you know, in and out, and I think it's really important for the children in our household to make sure they are confident to be able to speak to people who come into the house. And manners, we believe as a family, are one of our first and foremost principles in family life, because if you have nothing else in life and you have manners, then doors can open or close for you. You know, you can have all the wealth in the world, but you can be the rudest man, and nobody would like you, and nobody would want to be in your company, and nobody would want to do business with you. If you have manners, it can make or break a situation or an environment for you. So we teach our kids to be confident in meeting people. So one of the first things I always teach our kids is that when somebody comes in, they say, "Hello, my name is, nice to meet you." Or if they've met them before, "Hello, nice to see you again." And it's just very simple, and the kids are very comfortable saying it, but it gives the kids great confidence in being able to meet people. And also it just reinforces that basic management of you know, good old-fashioned manners in our book.
Now, adoption. I say I was adopted. I was brought up knowing I was adopted.
Yeah.
At one stage, I tried to brace the subject of my mum, and my mother took it very badly, so I left it, and then after she died, I did something about it. The point I'm going to make is some people in our family are adopted and don't know they're adopted. What are your thoughts on that? Should they be brought up knowing?
Well, I think, first of all, it's down to each person's own judgment to make that decision. You know, each adoptive parent's own judgment to make that decision. And I think that each circumstance is different. But in our experience and our understanding of the psychological dynamics that surround adoption, our view is very clearly that children should be told as early as possible that they're adopted. You know, and I'm talking from, you know, 18-month-old toddlers, that they were adopted and grow up in that knowledge that they have been chosen.
Which is exactly what my mum said. You've been picked.
Correct.
You weren't just had.
You were chosen.
You were picked.
You were chosen. You weren't born in my womb. Mm. You were born in my heart. Mm. And that's, you know, that's a huge, massive message to a child.
Did it take you a long time to adopt? Have they slowed it down at all? Have they made it any easier, or is it still difficult?
Well, our journey was slightly more difficult because of me practicing in the local area, etc. But generally, the route to adoption is
practicing
much
as in
a barrister.
As a barrister, yeah.
So our journey was a little bit more difficult, but generally, the route is now much quicker. And also now, if you have adopted in the last 5 years and you wish to adopt again, that process should be completed within 6 months.
Oh, wow.
So you can be fast-tracked, yeah, because you've had an awful lot of the previous inquiries into your life and etc. already completed.
So what would you say to anybody out there that is thinking of adopting and maybe thinking of fostering?
Well, I'd say two things. The first thing I'd say is, you know, you are welcome to get in touch with Mark or myself, irrelevant of whether you're a Liverpool, Everton or Tranmere fan. You know, we're there as human beings and as people who've gone through this experience, and we've had massive experience in both areas of fostering adoption, and that we'd be willing to assist you on that journey of making that transition to either being an adoptive parent or a foster carer. And secondly, you know, if you feel confident enough, then pick up the phone to your local authority and just make that call, and you'll get a visit from a social worker and have a talk through them with it, because there's nothing's going to be lost by either of those two routes of having a discussion either with ourselves or with your local authority. And there are kids out there who are desperate for loving homes.
Sue Wright, you're a lovely human being. I think your husband's fabulous. thank you for talking to us. And please become a friend of the show, and anything we can do to help.
Thank you so much, Pete. Lovely to see you.